Welcome to Calcio FC, your weekly dose of Italian football culture. This week, we celebrate one of Italy's iconic legends, his birthday, Roberto Baggio. But before we do that, let's drop in on Juventus with me, David Farini, your host of Calcio FC, and our senior writers, Dan Cantian and Emma Gates. Welcome, gents. It's time to talk about Juventus, the case study of Juventus. Interesting, after three consecutive Serie A wins, the impact of the last one could be massive. Changed the complexion of their series, changed the mood around Thiago Motta as well. That impact, the win over Inter, and what it means. Dan, I'll throw to you on this.
Well, I think at the moment it means nothing just yet because they have to back it up. But, you know, joking aside, it's massive for them, isn't it? The fact that it's not just beating Inter Milan, as you said, you know, their main rivals. It's the way they beat them. I thought the first half, you were hanging on. The first 45 minutes Inter should have been 1, 2, possibly 3 goals ahead. But they came back in the second half and they absolutely dominated the second half. They stopped Inter from playing, and that's probably the biggest compliment you can pay to them because they were so much better than Inter. The Inter had no answer for them, and the minute Conceição scored, you never thought Inter were going to come back. They looked flat. They look out of ideas. They look second best. And again, that's probably the biggest compliment you can pay Juve. Motta had Inzaghi's number in the second half.
Emmett, let's talk about the Derby d'Italia and what it means, why it's called a derby. I know that there was a lot of, we'll say, arguments over social media on the weekend. People, and especially targeting Adam Summerton, who was our guest last week. You haven't seen that, go and check it out on our YouTube channel. But people, they don't understand the history behind why it's called the Derby d'Italia.
Obviously, as you alluded to, we saw, not say the abuse, but Adam Summerton, who was, as you said, was on the pod last week, was getting some feedback on, obviously, he termed it the Derby d'Italia.
And people watching on TNT Sports.
Yeah, exactly. And people hear the word derby and think, well, Juventus are in Turin and Inter are from Milan. How is it a derby? But the term was coined by the legendary sports writer Gianni Brera in the 1960s. And it basically alludes to the fact that Juve and Inter are the most successful teams in the history of Italian football. They won the most trophies. They have the most prestige. They have the biggest fan bases. So basically, it's known as the Derby of Italy, even though there's no geographical proximity to each other in the way that Inter and Milan is or Roma and Lazio. But it's basically, as we said in the stadium, David, in our video, it's all about prestige and titles, and that's why it was coined the Derby.
It's the same dynamic that you will have in England with Manchester United and Liverpool, that you'll have with like PSG and Marseille in France,
or Bayern Munich and Borussia
Dortmund. Yeah, Barcelona and Real Madrid. I mean, there is no proximity on the geographical level, even though there's only about, 90 minutes between Turin and Milan?
Yeah.
But when you look at the standing of the two clubs, the prestige, as Emmett said, the fans, it is probably the biggest game in Italian football, arguably after the derby, the Milan derby, I think.
Let's talk about some analysis, the impact of new players at Juventus, Dan Colomuani.
I mean, it is being superb for them. It's interesting, actually, because Juve spent so much money in the summer. They spent about £150 million on players. And the best player is someone who signed on loan. You know,
he's some player, though. Like,
oh, he's been...
He's not an unknown.
No, he's not an unknown, but it does make you think, though, like, the fact that he was available in January for a start and the fact that there was seemingly no competition for him, you know, I know, like...
I think it depends what players, what mindset they're in at the time in that January window and if they've fallen out with their current manager at their other club and then
to go to. I think, you know, Juventus deserve credit for identifying him as available to start with
and then
picking him up because... Yeah. Yeah, you would have thought that the likes of, you know, Premier League clubs would be all over him. You know, he's a proven quality striker, still young. He's very versatile because he's not a traditional number nine. You know, he can play across the front three. And it's been transformational for Juventus. He scored 5 in his first 3 games. The first player to do so since Roberto Baggio, I believe, in the
1990.
In 1990. And his performance on Sunday night was fantastic. That goal doesn't happen unless he plays that pass through to Conceição while being fouled. I mean, watching on TV, I thought he's going to give a penalty here.
Yeah.
And then he still managed to thread the pass through for Conceição, who then did his bit. Look, it's great. Colomuani has been superb. I think the question now is, what do you do? Do they go all out for him in the summer and they sign him on a permanent deal, or do they send him back?
Surely it's a question of if he can maintain this form.
Yeah.
But you will take, you'll take a gamble on him. But that's the question, I think. Like, how
are they going to pay for it?
Well, exactly.
I think there is, I read in Gazzetta this week, there is discussions that Juve would take him on another loan a full season next year, and then attempt to sign him in the summer of 2026.
And that all plays into their financial.
Yeah,
they did that with Morata, didn't they? They signed him for two consecutive seasons on loan. It just seems bizarre, though, doesn't it?
Another player that's had a massive impact is the actual goal scorer, Francisco Conceição. Emmett, that impact.
Yeah, exactly. If you look at the numbers, he hasn't been that particularly stellar. It's like
three goals
and five assists.
But still, as a wide man.
It's when you're at the stadium, you realize the work ethic, the defensive diligence that he carries out. He's always constantly harassing the opposition players. And I think it's when you compare Conceição to someone like Rafael Leão, who's really good going forward, but defensively doesn't put in a shift, doesn't put in any effort.
Conceição was everywhere. He was
and
everywhere.
He's only 22. You know, obviously, Sergio, his dad, the current Milan coach, was an accomplished winger in his own right, obviously, for Lazio and Inter in the late 90s and early 90s. But I think Francesco has a lot more in his locker in terms of he can beat his men. He's good at dribbling one-on-one duels. And the fact that he does help out, it reminded me a lot of Pavel Nedved in that sense, obviously the other side. But the fact that he's good going forward, but he also puts in a shift going back, and that Juventus fans love those kind of wingers that are good in both halves of the pitch. And
Chiesa is gone.
Yeah.
Conceição's in.
Exactly.
No, it's definitely ever been a better time of it than his dad, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, at the exactly. moment, yeah. I mean, what Sergio would give to get his son over to...
I was going to say, to have him over, I think it would be...
And I think if you look at Juve's wingers like Keenan Yeldiz and Nico Gonzalez, they're not particularly quick. They don't have that burst of acceleration.
Yeah.
But Conceição does, and he's so good at beating his man in one-on-ones, and Juve need that.
We'll go to Adam Summerton's point last week where he said there are reasons why Juve aren't challenging for the title. It's a case of don't try and run before you can walk. And that's what Juve are trying to do now with Motta. He's trying to get them. He's trying to mold them into these versatile players. That's what I'm thinking anyway. In order to compete in Serie A, Adam goes on, they need the money from the Champions League, which they're still playing in. So I understand that it's important that they're fighting on both fronts. And it is. They need as much as they can from every competition. So that loss of 200 million have got some depth. No Vlahovic, I should mention, he didn't come off the bench. It could be a sign of things to come that they want to ship him out. They'll get money from that if they can then use it to fund Colomwani's shift in on a full-time basis.
Well, also Conceição is another one because he signed on loan from Porto for 7 million last summer, and Juve have the option to buy him for 30 this summer. So I think they can't sign Colomwani and Conceição. It might have to be, okay, maybe we'll work out a deal and get Colomwani in another year's time, but sign Conceição this summer.
Yeah, and we've seen them, you know, needing defenders before, and they've had to put money into Renato Vega.
Yeah.
They had Hughes, and they had to sell him for different reasons, but it all ties into them trying to keep their books balanced.
Yeah.
They're going to need to win something soon to justify it all, surely. Juventini, you know, we know the history, the legacy of the club, what it means to win trophies in the black and white there. But surely Motta needs a little bit more time. The media in general has been quite critical of him.
Yeah, I think what hasn't helped, and we've talked about this on the pod before, is the fact that Cristiano Giuntoli spent 200 million last summer. That's added the pressure from the get-go. But I do think, to be fair to Juventus, they are willing to stick with him, even if they don't qualify for the Champions League. Obviously, it's imperative that they do because of the financial outlay, as you mentioned. But I do think they are going to give Motta time, which is something they never give Pirlo or they never give Sarri when they try to go to a nicer way of playing football. It was one season out, even if they won trophies. So I do think they've learned from that and they're willing to give Motta another season.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting paradox for them because obviously they were serial winners under Conte and under Allegri. But particularly under Allegri, the football, as we all know, wasn't exactly exciting. You know, it wasn't pretty to watch. But then you go from, you know, it's a short leap going from winning almost every season to then playing catch up with your rivals. And whether we like it or not, money is crucial in the game.
Yeah, well, when you're at the top, everyone wants to beat
exactly.
you.
Exactly. And you know, you look at the likes of, you know, Milan and or, you know, the likes of United out of the Champions League, that you become just another club because the money, that you're missing out on is huge.
Yeah, it's
and the money, the money is then not just in terms of transfer, but then it means you need to become a selling club, or you need to, if not a selling club, you can't afford to keep certain players on the wage that, that they will like, and that means you need to move them on, because otherwise you run the risk of losing them for free. So there is all this sort of like these domino effects. It's not just the prestige of being in the Champions League, which as fans is the main thing. But from a financial standpoint, if you're not in the Champions League, then you're playing catch up with your rivals.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, case in point is the fact that Juventus, as it stands, have earned 63 million euros from the Champions League from what, 9 games? Like, that is serious money.
I wouldn't mind that in my account, but do the players see this as a transitional year, do you think, under Motta?
They do, but I think there is, it only goes so far, because as I said earlier, the players need to buy into the managers and his system, but ultimately they want to win trophies. So yeah, you can probably tell them it's a transitional season, you know, we're building towards something else. You saw it with, like, with Inzaghi in this first season at Inter Milan, and with Conte at Inter Milan. You're seeing it with Conte now. Conte's been at pains to stress that in Napoli aren't competing for the title. You know, it's a transitional season. You saw it with Jurgen Klopp at Liverpool. You know, that the players were building toward, like, he told the players, we're building towards something bigger. However, the proof is in the pudding, ultimately. So if you don't win, you can tell the players, we're building towards something all you like, but they want to win trophies, and, you know, it doesn't take much for them to sort of become, I'm not saying that they lose faith in the manager, but you obviously become frustrated and you're like, well, show me some results.
We'll wrap up the Juventus chat there. This is the Calcio FC podcast with me, David Freeney, joined by Dan Cancian and Emmett Gates, the Destination Calcio senior writers. And what a week it is. It's Roberto Baggio week. It's his birthday. He's turned 58. Seems like it is a lifetime ago where he scored all those great goals for Italy. But everyone loves him. He's so revered around the world. Arguably the greatest Italian player. Some even think he might be the best player of all time. Just judging him on the length of his career, the duration, 22 years he played. Started off at Vicenza, went through Fiorentina, went to Juventus, Milan, Bologna, Inter, finished up at Brescia. What a career. Some underrated goals there, which Emmett's done a piece on. 5 underrated goals. You can go check that out on destinationcalcio.com. 3 World Cup goals that we've written about. He scored 9 in total, along with Paolo Rossi and Vieri. He's the joint top scorer there. Let's talk about those 3 goals before we get into Roberto himself, just in case you're listening. Mr. Baggio, if you've learned English somehow, we're going to talk about your goals at the World Cup. Let's start off because, Dan, we picked one each, and it was from the 3 different World Cups that he's played in, 1990, 94, and 98. Of course, the most important or the best goal of each individual World Cup. Dan, take it away because you did 1990.
Yeah, so the 1990 World Cup, as I said in my piece, I think it's an interesting paradox because we have this idea now of, you know, hoping glitz and glamour and, you know, Pavarotti belting out Nessun Dorma, which is true. And it should have been the greatest World Cup anyone has ever seen because Italy was, at the time, the home of the best league in the world by far. There was no Premier League. The first division in England was shambles.
Yeah, when you put it into context.
Yeah, in a historical
foreign
context.
Foreign players weren't even allowed into Italy until, what, the early 80s?
Yeah, again. Exactly.
And it was only the 3 best.
Yeah.
So Zico at Udinese, you know, Maradona's coming in, and that was the level, the pedigree dripping.
Yeah, it was like, you know, and then you had, obviously, the likes of the San Siro being refurbished, the Olimpico being given a facelift, the Dele Alpi
everything
being
milled.
Yeah, not that I would put the Dele Alpi in part with San Siro. Anyway, that's for a whole other podcast. But when you actually, and then you look at the players, you had the likes of, you know, Maradona at his peak, Lothar Matthäus, Rijkaard, Gullit, Van Basten. But the football per se wasn't actually that thrilling. If you look at it, it was very defensive. It was stodgy. It wasn't exactly free-flowing football as we know it. And yet, there is this sort of wave of nostalgia that has been triggered by Italia 90. And I think it's interesting because when you do actually look at some of the goals that we saw at the tournament, some of the goals was fantastic. And yeah, and the goal that I think the goal that Baggio scored against Czechoslovakia is probably the goal of the tournament, or one of the goals of the tournament. And I love the goal. I mean, full disclosure, it is one of my favourite goals I've ever seen. And what I like about it is the lack of structure, because everything that we watch these days is structure. You see goals that are, I'm not saying that every team scores the same goals, but they tend to be very formulaic. And when you look at this goal, you see the fact itself that Giannini receives the ball in space and he's got so much space around him. And then he placed it into Baggio's part. And Baggio, this was his first start because, you know, he was on the bench for the first two games because Vicini, the Italian manager, preferred Vialli and Cannavale up front.
And this was Schillaci Baggio.
Yeah, and he gets the ball and he's got the number 15 on his back, as you're having on your shirt right now.
Wore this in dedication to the great man, Roberto.
So. And it is like, he's just, he gets the ball in a position where a left winger will get a ball right now. And he was obviously like a number 10 at the time.
And around halfway.
Yeah, around halfway. And he goes past a defender and it's the kind of tackle that at the tackle met its intended target. It could have been like a leg break.
Ankle snapped.
Yeah, absolutely. And then anyway, he jinks past another defender. And if you look at the videos, it's one of those things that like, I always have an image of him touching the ball several times. But then I looked at the video again this week for the piece. And it doesn't actually touch the ball more than three times. It just shimmies one way, then
left,
the other.
Left foot onto the right. When you see it from the reverse angle, you see the first touch is on the left to bring it to the right. Yeah. And he skips away.
And then it turns the defenders inside out. And by the time the defender is actually facing the right way, it's far too late.
Because Miroslav Kadlec.
Yes.
The poor guy. I was going to say, I mean, what do you do? When you see those highlights, everyone knows Baggio from that goal.
Yeah.
And that poor defender.
Yeah, he has to
watch that and just see himself get bamboozled both ways. It was like leg spinner from Shane Warne. He just had no idea where
he was
going.
It is exactly like that. And the thing is that by the time Baggio gets into the box, the keeper, Yunus Tezcal, is almost already diving because he's just trying to predict which way the ball is going to go. And I don't think that Baggio actually makes a great connection with the ball either. He sort of just like strokes it into the far corner. And what really gets me is his celebration because, you know, it was his first goal of the World Cup on his World Cup debut. And he runs away and then he just collapses onto the turf and he's almost like astonished by how good that goal was. There's the kind of like realization going, oh gosh, I've done something amazing on the grandest stage of all. And this was a difficult period for Baggio, you know, if you want to put it in an historical context. He had already been injured twice, he did his ACL twice while he was a teenager. Yeah. And you know, he was already one of the Serie A's best players, but it was 23, he had two big knee injuries.
He did the first one in Serie C playing for Vicenza, where he started
on his last day.
Took a risk to bring him in, and then he couldn't play for a while.
And by the Italian anti-World Cup, he had been sold to Juventus for £8 million at the time. And there was the feeling that Baggio was it really worth it? Was it worth the hassle? Was it worth the money? You know, everyone said, well, there is a reason why Vicini has him on the bench in the first two games. He's a luxury player. Italy can't carry passengers, you know. All this sort of like the rumour that the hullabaloo around him, it was just about the fact that it was a big transfer fee going from Fiorentina to Juventus, almost causing a riot in the process. Not that he wanted any part in it. We should...
3 days of rats in Florence.
There's still bitterness over that at the moment. Yeah, there's still bitterness. Every time they play, they bring that up.
Yeah,
exactly. And so I think there was very much a case of him wanting to prove himself. And, you know, it's never been one of the most sort of like vocal and sort of extrovert player, if you want. He's always done talking on the pitch.
Yeah.
And I think that when you look at it in the context, you know, that was the moment where he probably first established himself in the...
In the minds and in
the conscience of Italians scoring that goal, it was like, look, I'm here, this is what I'm capable of.
It was a statement goal.
It was a statement goal, yeah.
And one thing, if you listen to Robbie Baggio since his career's finished, he's been quite timid. He's known as this timid character. You know, there's two sides to the Baggio tale, just like there is with many other great footballers. But he will tell you that during that time when Fiorentina signed him from Vicenza, he spent a lot of time trying to recover. And even later on in his career, he had to train twice just to stay fit enough to make it to the pitch. So his whole, and Guardiola alluded to this recently as well, well, at the end of 2024, where he said how emotional he gets thinking about the pain and suffering Baggio had to go through just to keep playing. And there were times during his career where he could have given up. And if it wasn't for him turning to Buddhism, and just going to buy music while he was in Florence, he'd go to the local music store. He met the guy, the salesman behind the counter. We get talking to him. He happened to be a Buddhist. And Baggio was explaining to him how, you know, he's having some mental health issues. He needed some help in many, many ways. He didn't know he was going to play anymore. And next thing, the gentleman from, I can't remember his name, unfortunately, but he would go to Fiorentina's training camp and Baggio would wake up an hour before the rest of the team to go and meditate and practice Buddhism so that he could keep the mental strength, the self-belief. And he also talks about his father in a lot of these documentaries where he's taken a few of the qualities that his father tried to teach him and, you know, try and just keep the faith. And eventually it paid off. He had to believe in himself. Everyone was losing their faith in him, but he kept it. And that goal, the first one, he talks about Fiorentina, the goal against Napoli, where he realized just how powerful he could be, but he wouldn't have been able to get to that point. That was before the World Cup. He wouldn't be able to get to that point if he wasn't able to believe in himself. So there's a lot of life lessons in Roberto Baggio's career. And that goal for Italy that you're talking about against Czechoslovakia was another milestone moment for him because he was able to realize, I'm now on the world stage. I've done it at club level, done it in the best league, and now I've done it on the world stage in Italy, right here in front of all my home fans.
Yeah,
and that was the dive. And
really, I think that is also the fact with the mental strength you're alluding to. It's important to note that like the injuries that Baggio had in today's football, it will be a significant setback, but you will still be expected to come back from that kind of stuff, you know, with surgery. When he played, that could have been a career ender.
But it was a death sentence.
Like if you compare, you compare the scars that you would be left with back then, where surgery on your ACL compared to the one you'll get now, it'd be like, you know, having a minor scratch or having a gunshot wound.
And his second ACL that he sustained at Fiorentina not long after he had just joined, he had to get 220 stitches behind his knee, and he's allergic to penicillin. And he asked his mum to put him out of his misery. He's like, he thought he was going to die because of the pain and the fact that he was allergic to penicillin, and he had to go through all this pain without any medication. And the fact that he come back and reached the levels that he did win a Ballon d'Or, it's staggering, really, when you think about it.
Yeah. And I think that's why he's so universally loved, because it's very hard to find footballers who play for three of the biggest clubs in Italy to be so universally loved.
Yeah, and that's, people do love him, and he even said that he discussed with his wife that that missed penalty in 94 against Brazil, it was a sign that he was human because he'd done so much. Of course, he's had his ups and downs with Sacchi on the way to scoring his five goals that got him, and we'll talk about that goal soon, to get to that final. But he should never have played in that final. He had the hamstring injury from the semi-final, and it's just another setback in a long list of setbacks for him, and he was able to persevere. And another life lesson there from Robbie Baggio. Doesn't know that he is a philosopher of sorts, but he is.
Yeah. Well, the famous Uruguayan writer Eduardo Galeano, he spoke about Diego Maradona saying that he was the most human of the gods. And I think that applies to Baggio and why people love him, because he had this talent that was genius, but he's sadly, for rightly or wrongly, remembered for a penalty miss in a final. So it kind of shows he's one of us. He's mortal like us. He's not this, obviously his talent's up here, but he makes mistakes like the rest of us. He's fallible, and he is a human god.
Yeah,
and I think that's why he's loved.
Demigods, both of them, because you had Maradona that led up to 1990. Baggio then took the mantle, and he flew the flag for footballing demigods until that penalty miss where people realised he was...
I think it's significant, actually, on the point that Emmett is making about being fallible, because if you think of Italian 90, you think of Baggio and you think of Paul Gascoigne, who was himself a genius, albeit a flawed genius at that. But, you know, both of them, I think that's why people could relate with the pair of them, because they were so human, so, you know, fallible. They were, Baggio's issues were mostly physical, Gazza's were, you know, mental, and the alcohol demons he faced. But, you know, you could, as a fan, you could relate to them. You know, they were effectively people like you will know your mates would be like them.
Yeah.
But they just happened to be phenomenally good footballers.
Yeah. And that's what he also says. Baggio has admitted that he never thought he was any better than anyone else in the team. Going back to the roots of him kicking Scotch tape makeshift footballs that he had with Eddie and his other brothers in the hallway back when he was a child. So let's move on to the next goal. That was mine. It was USA 94. It was against Bulgaria. It's the fifth and final goal that I'm talking about here. It's not the first goal against Bulgaria where he scored a fairly similar, and that's why I didn't go with his goal, probably known as his best goal of the World Cup to many, is that throw in, he gets the ball, he takes off and he cuts in from that left wing again. and curls it in the other corner this time instead of that near corner against the Czechoslovakians. He found the bottom corner to beat Mihailov, which is one of the best keepers of the tournament, curled it into that bottom far corner. And I went with the second goal because, to me, it's a very different goal to that first one. It showed just the momentum that Italy had. They were firing on all cylinders. They should have won the 1990 World Cup, according to many. They should be able to win this one. Baggio had such a slow start to the World Cup. He was substituted against Norway.
After 20 minutes?
Yeah, because
Marcogiani gets sent off.
There was a red card, yeah. And then we've got him struggling against Nigeria, searing heat. He goes on about how bad the heat was. Every Italian goes on about how bad the heat was in America that World Cup. But finally, he's got to this point in his career. He's at the culmination. He smashes this ball, beautiful ball over the top from Albertini.
And yeah, I think the ball itself from Albertini is
as good as the finish itself.
It's superb.
And it's that Albertini to Baggio combination, Roberto Baggio, because Dino Baggio also played in that game. of the final six goals in that tournament, because the final ended 0-0, but there were six goals in the knockouts, all scored by Baggio's, one by Dino, five by Robbie. And he was hauling Italy to greatness the whole country was on his shoulders. Very different to Italian 90, where Schillaci did a lot of it. This time it was Baggio, no Schillaci. He had Signori. We saw Zola sent off against Nigeria. He was available for that semi-final, wasn't he? But he wasn't used. He wasn't used in the final either. I wish he was. But Baggio was able to smash that ball off the laces, across the keeper. Beautiful. Found the other corner. So one corner for the first goal, one corner for the second goal. Showed just how good he was. World class. No one could touch him. Just won the Ballon d'Or. Incredible. And then we see what happened afterwards, which we don't want to touch on too much about the penalty, but we've already spoken about it. It was his moment of humility. Should never have played because he did his hamstring straight after he scored that second goal. He's come back in the second half and done his hamstring. It was taken off in tears. And that's where we see just how you can go from such a high to such a low. And that is the roller coaster.
And again, I think there are lessons in that particular injury because Italy played all their games on the East Coast and they had to travel to Pasadena for the final.
Yeah. Of all places, Pasadena for a World Cup final. And mark that one down.
Yeah. And at midday.
Yeah.
The fact that you have to spend, 6 hours on a flight does nothing if you have an hamstring injury. Like, it doesn't help recovery in any way, shape or form.
Yeah, his preparation for the final was kicking a ball against a wall in a reception room where they have weddings.
And
for the biggest game of your life, that is what your preparation is.
When Arrigo Sacchi was incredibly superstitious, and when he saw what happened to Baggio, he thought this may be a sign that, the stars aren't aligning for us. And he told the Italy chief press officer or communication manager, whatever you want to call him, when they got to Pasadena, he said to him, "I don't want any calls coming into my room. I don't want anyone interfering with me," because Sacchi was paranoid with people wishing him good luck ahead of any game, particularly big games. He was woken up, legend has that he was woken up at 4 a.m. by a girl calling from Bologna saying, "I just want to wish you good luck for the final, because I know that, with Baggio not being at his best, you will need all the best, all the wishes of good luck from everyone in Italy. I just want to wish you good luck." And apparently Sacchi, the moment he received that call, he just knew that the game was going to go Brazil's way.
Well, I mean, back then, you had to make a special effort to take a phone call.
Yeah.
Up against the wall. They're affixed to the wall, the big long cord. He should have just left it.
But the thing is that, that girl who made the call was never actually identified, and there are, I wouldn't say conspiracy theories, but legend has it that someone may have actually set it up to just make the phone call purely to derail Sacchi's.
Get in Sacchi's mind.
Get in Sacchi's mind. Also, back then, I would imagine calling an international hotel in the States from Italy must have cost a fortune.
From Bologna to Pasadena, what a cost.
Yeah, and also, I know that this is something we're going off on a tangent, but how is it possible to just call in a hotel and go, "No, I want to be put through to Italy's manager"?
Yeah,
don't they have standards of don't they actually check?
Yeah, it seems.
She's ringing around every hotel in Pasadena. Is Italy staying here?
Yeah. And Igor's still around. We need to interview him and see if that was legit, that phone call or not. But usually you wouldn't take those. What a team that was back then. Pagliuca, Musi, Baresi, Maldini, Benarivo, Berti, Dino Baggio, Albertini, Donadoni, Roberto Baggio, and Massaro. We'll wrap up the 94 goal. We'll go to 1998. Emmett, take us to France.
Obviously, Italy didn't win France 98, but I think for Roberto on a personal level, it was a story of redemption. You know, that period from USA 94 to France 98, he almost kind of become an outcast in Serie A. He had one more season at Juve. He got injured. And then Alessandro Del Piero, a young Del Piero, come along. And basically Juventus were like, you know what? Del Piero's quicker. He's more tactically versatile. We could actually do without Baggio and we'll put our faith in Del Piero. So he was sold to Milan. And he was supposed to go to Milan 5 years beforehand, but there was an agreement between Gianni Agnelli and Silvio Berlusconi. Basically, Agnelli told Berlusconi, look, just leave Baggio for us because Milan already had Van Basten and Rijkaard and Hullet and they were winning everything. So he wins the Scudetto with Juve in 95. He wins another one with Milan in 96, but he's not the pivotal player in either title. Obviously, Milan at that point, you have Savicevic.
So many class players.
George
Weah, yeah.
You have Boban there. Obviously, in Juventus, there was Vialli, Ravanelli, Del Piero. So his stock has fallen. His second year at Milan is disastrous. Sacchi comes in and them two are at war. Basically, Baggio hardly gets a kick in the second half of the 96-97 season.
And didn't go to Euro 96 either.
And he's left him out of Euro 96. Sacchi basically, once Pasadena happens, Sacchi basically drops him for the final 2 years of his reign. Baggio tries to start a dressing room revolt to get rid of him because they're like, look, his style of play is killing us.
And he was only 29, 30 at the time. Yeah, Roberto Baggio, yeah.
And they played a Euro 96 qualifier against Croatia in Palermo. And Italy lost at home. And Baggio was like, right, enough's enough. We need to get rid of this guy. He keeps chopping and changing the team. Like, Sacchi never played the same team twice.
110 call-ups.
Yeah, it was something ridiculous. So Sacchi ignored him.
It proves that he loves getting on the phone. So he should have just been receptive to that girl back in...
Well, maybe. Sure,
exactly. And so then, obviously, he doesn't go to Euro 96. He's still at Milan. Sacchi then ends up back with a second spell at Milan for the second half of 96-97. It doesn't go well. Sacchi leaves. Capello comes back, who had wanted him at Milan. Capello was like, look, Roberto, there's no room for you here. It's better you find another club. There's a deal agreed with Parma and Carlo Ancelotti, who was a Sacchi disciple at the time, strict 4-4-2. Ancelotti rings him up and goes, Roberto, there's no room for you. I've got Hernan Crespo, Enrico Chiesa. There's no room for you here. I don't want you. So
fair enough.
He finds himself at Bologna, of all places. He was linked with Man United, I think, in that summer because Cantona had left. So you replace one maverick for another. But he wanted to stay in Italy because at that point, leaving Italy was kind of a death sentence to play for the Azzurri because Serie A, at that time, was still the greatest league, you know, probably in the history of the sport.
Yeah.
So he wanted to stay in Italy. He ends up at Bologna. He gets 22 goals, and then Sacchi leaves Italy. Cesare Maldini comes in. Cesare Maldini gives him a chance. He goes to France as an understudy to Del Piero. Del Piero gets injured in the 1998 Champions League final against Real Madrid. So he's not fit for the first couple of games. He plays against Chile and he scores a penalty against Chile.
And that assist for Christian Vieri.
Yeah, he has a brilliant assist. So Maldini plays a long ball to Baggio. Paolo Maldini, not Cesare. Baggio, one touch, like a volleyed pass into the path of Bobo Vieri, who first time finished into the bottom corner. Brilliant. Marcelo Salas then scores two goals for Chile. Then 5 minutes from the end, Baggio wins a penalty where he chips
that
the ball
cross
into the hand, hits the Chilean defender in the hand. He takes the penalty. And there's a lot of pressure because
his
previous penalty for Italy was the final in Pasadena. Yeah. 4 years later, he's now taking another penalty to rescue a point for Italy. He scores it. The next game against Cameroon, Del Piero still not fit. He provides an assist, I think, for Luigi Di Biagio in a 3-0 win. Then you get to Austria, the third game. He's dropped for Del Piero. Del Piero's back in the side along with Bobo.
They were going through. It was like 1970 between Sandro Mazzola and Gianni Rivera. There was this relay,
Staffetta, as they call it in Italian, where basically Del Piero and Baggio were fighting for the number 10 role. But so in the Austria, the final game, Italy's already through. Baggio and Pippo Inzaghi kind of combine nice. It's a nice give and go. and we actually see an Inzaghi assist, which is that's a collector's item.
That's actually what makes it such a good goal for me, because
Exactly. I mean, it's not the greatest goal of the 90s scored. It's a tap in essentially from.
It's a general play goal,
but it's the general player's name. Yeah, and I think it kind of caps off the redemption arc in the fact that he had four difficult years. He was, you know, he was vilified for missing that penalty, you know, by Italians after USA 84. And then he had worked his way back. You know, he'd been rejected by so many clubs, outcast, and the comeback. And then you get to the quarterfinal with France, and there's still a lot of debate to this day whether he should have started ahead of Del Piero, because Maldini then went with Del Piero and Vieri up front. Baggio was dropped to the bench against France, and Del Piero was basically non-existent at that tournament.
He's
Del Piero never transferred his form for Juventus like he did for Italy, whereas Baggio was opposite. He saved his best for the Azzurri, whereas Del Piero just...
That is the image of him, isn't he, against France, where he connects, the ball comes over the top and he connects with the ball.
The first time volley, it just whistles past
and he looks around and he does that, sort of like point I budged by how much he missed.
And he talked about that in recent years.
That would have been one of the greatest World Cup goals ever scored.
And that would have been golden goal. So France were out if that goes in. But he said in recent times that he didn't realise, he watched it back and he said he didn't realise he had that much time. If he had to do it again, he would let the ball bounce once and then volley it, and he likely would have scored. But again, that speaks to the small margins between failure and success that kind of represent Baggio's
career.
Split
second decision.
Yeah, exactly. And it just went past the post. But I think France 98 for him, he leaves a hero. You know, his reputation is restored. He gets the big move to Inter, which was a disaster.
Because he also scored a penalty against France in the shootout.
Exactly. I think it's Zidane and Baggio go first to kind of set the tone, both score. So he leaves France 98 a hero. He gets the move to Inter, which is a disaster. And that's, that's for another episode. But I think that whole period he leaves, you know, it's about redemption and, you know, didn't completely mask the pain of Pasadena. I think it'll haunt him to the day he dies. But he leaves a hero. The Italian people's faith in him is restored. And again, like I said, not the greatest goal, but for what it meant and the context, it's important in his career.
Yeah, there's a story of heroism and heartbreak in each Baggio World Cup.
And I think that when you look at the 94 World Cup, it's almost a social media moment long before social media, because the penalty miss against Brazil has been, it's a clip in itself, isn't it? And everyone thinks, well, maybe not everyone, but a lot of people who may be like casual fans think, oh, it cost them the World Cup. Had he scored, Brazil may well have won anyway, because they were still at the penalty to take. You know?
Yeah, and Baresi had missed already.
Yeah, exactly.
So Baggio, even if he scored that,
he was keeping
Brazil had won to win it after.
Exactly, yeah.
And but him and Baresi, they were identical penalties as well.
Yeah. And Baresi shouldn't have played the final.
And both had hamstring injuries. Yeah. Exactly. And both shouldn't have played. So, well, there's plenty more that we could speak about Roberto Baggio. And if you want more on Baggio, head over to the standalone video that we've done on the great man, the great number 10, 15, and number 18. That's it from me, David Farini. Another episode of Calcio FC in the bag. Special thanks going out to Emmett Gates and Dan Cancian, our Destination Calcio senior writers. We'll let you know our socials just in case you want to get in contact with us. I'm at David Farini _ Emmett.
At Emmett Gates.
And I'm at Dan _Cancian.
And be sure to join us every Thursday for our pod on YouTube, also on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. And don't forget, you can watch Serie B live and exclusive in the UK, the USA, the Caribbean, and the South Americas, Mexico as well, DC TV. Download that app today or go to tv.destinationcalcio.com. Live Serie B, 3 games every week. That's it for this week. Calcio FC podcast. Remember, the destination is always Calcio.